Hello, everybody. This is Oscar Dahl. I'm here with Matthew Knutson, and this is We Like Movies. Matthew, how's it going, buddy?
Good. We've been doing this morning thing for the last couple episodes now, and I have no reason to complain about that because I'm 3 hours ahead of you. So
yeah, it's good for you.
It's something. I think the sun still isn't up in your part of the world.
No, not for another hour, in fact. It's ridiculous. I decided that I had to wake up a little more than I had been the last couple episodes, so I got up super early, went to the gym, and now I feel like my brain is in a good place. So
you always been hopefully a morning person, or is this something that's come with with the 30s and motivation to get up earlier and get your day started?
It depends. I mean, I've always been a not sleep too much person.
Interesting.
But as I've learned to sleep more, I've also gone to bed earlier to get stuff done in the morning. But yeah, no, I think given my druthers, like if I was retired or unemployed, I think I would stay up late and sleep in. It's been a long time since I've had that option. So yeah, who knows? But anyway, yes, I guess I'm an old man morning person now. So thanks for bringing that up.
No, it's good. It's good. I mean, it's not like I had to get up and go to the gym or get up and go to work or something. I got to get up and start this conversation, which is a pretty easy thing. You know, like I don't feel quite as much of an urge to hit my snooze button as I would if I was doing something I didn't want to do.
Matt, it's Thanksgiving week.
Mm-hmm.
How about that?
Yeah, I guess this is what we have to deal with on Thanksgiving week, Justice League.
Yeah, what's your favorite Thanksgiving movie? There's only one in my mind.
I mean, it's got to be Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, right?
Yeah. Are there any others?
I think Home for the Holidays is technically a Thanksgiving movie, not a Christmas movie.
I guess that's true.
Jodie Foster film. No, other than that, it's really not a holiday.
Family Stone, isn't that a Thanksgiving movie?
I've never seen it. Couldn't tell you.
Anyway,
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is obviously the right answer.
Yes.
But that movie all takes place on the road, obviously, right? Hence the title.
Yeah, so you're not getting way to Thanksgiving. Right. I mean, their quest is Thanksgiving. So,
does your family gather around and watch movies on Thanksgiving in preparation for the inevitable feast, or is it pretty much football and actual face-to-face conversations?
It's football and a lot of competitive card games.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, or maybe we'll throw in some Settlers of Catan there, too. It's a lot of competition, really.
I see. Very Norwegian.
Yes, exactly. All right. Well, that has been Thanksgiving talk from We Like Movies. Moving on. Matt, we have a trio of films that we need to discuss today, all very different in scope and quality.
Truly.
We're going to talk about Lady Bird, Murder on the Orient Express, and the aforementioned Justice League. I don't think either of us were happy to go see Justice League, but we did it for you, the listener, out of obligation. Right, Matt?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Yeah, it truly felt like homework. I don't want to, tease our reactions to the film too much, but it definitely was the kind of thing that I sort of had to drag myself kicking and screaming to go do. Plus, the worst part was I have a MoviePass, of course. I'm a very proud MoviePass holder. But this is one of those situations where I couldn't find a screening that worked in my schedule to use the MoviePass. So I ended up having to pay. And MoviePass doesn't work for IMAX screenings, of course, right? Premium screenings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I ended up needing to pay the $23 to go see this on the IMAX screen.
Oh my God.
But, I'm a big IMAX guy, and I do like to support the format. And they actually did shoot some of this in IMAX, so I got myself convinced that I was doing it for the sort of like academic technical research I could do. The thing I'll always go back to when talking about this film is, well, at least it's short, right?
Exactly. Compared that's the first thing I said once the credits hit. But I think we're going to start in reverse order of quality. With a little movie called Lady Bird,
tearing up the platforms out there right now.
Yeah, this is Greta Gerwig's directorial debut, written, directed by her, based on her life. One everyone has sort of surmised, taking place in Sacramento, coming of age story about a young girl on her way to college, and it is one of the rare films with a wide critical sort of wide critical net that is 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. You don't see that very often. 147 reviews, all good reviews. Were you stoked to see this movie? When was the first time you heard of it? What are your thoughts on Greta Gerwig?
I had a couple of friends who caught it at Telluride and had nothing but wonderful things to say about it, and that included people who I consider to be pretty darn high standards for these kinds of precious indie properties. Mm-hmm. Including some people who actually outwardly dislike Greta Gerwig and dislike her personality and sort of her general sort of approach to everything. I think your opinion about Greta Gerwig going into this thing is definitely going to temper you. But if ever there was a movie to sort of, I guess, teach you what she's all about or to maybe make you reconsider your thoughts about her, it certainly is this film. I mean, she's not in it, of course, so that probably helps, but she certainly has her fingerprints all over it. I was sort of indifferent about her, really. I had enjoyed her collaborations with Noah Baumbach. I guess I was sort of like kind of indifferent about the film before it started tearing up the festival circuit. But then when I heard it was wonderful, my expectations started getting higher and higher and higher. By the time I finally saw it here at Columbia for a sneak preview screening, I had pretty darn high expectations for this thing. And I have to say they were actually surpassed. And I'm definitely on board with this being one of the most critically acclaimed films of the year, definitely one of the best films I've seen this year, and a movie that just, I don't know, I just keep thinking about it, I guess. I've seen it twice now, and I just sort of can't get it out of my head, and the more I think about it, the more I like it. What are your feelings about Greta Gerwig? That's probably a good place to start.
I've been a fan. You know, I don't think all of her movies have been great. I like, I'd say, most of her work with Noah Baumbach. I like Frances Ha a hell of a lot more than, say, Greenberg.
Sure.
And I've never had any sort of issues with her as or her personality anyway. I've always thought she was pretty adorable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hadn't heard much about this movie. I think for whatever reason, maybe it was just the branding or the poster or just the log line. But I was going in sort of, at least a week or two before release, thinking that this was a super, super dramatic, like almost melodramatic type film. And I don't know why, but something about it made me think this is like a period piece or something, and it kind of is. I wasn't expecting it to be this much of a comedy. I loved it. I think it's one of the best movies of the year. I mean, I think we are, not uniquely, but this movie is directly for us at our age. I mean, this is a movie about a girl going to school, finishing high school in 2003, we finished high school in 2001, right?
Yes.
And it is a period piece in that way. And it is like, you know, we went to a private school, like she went to a private school, and Sacramento and Seattle are fairly similar, in their atmosphere. So this movie was very, very specifically directed towards us. And I think people our age are going to be highly receptive to it.
That's 100% true, and it's important to talk about. We are basically contemporaries. I think Greta Gerwig is, you know, like 9 months younger than you or something, and about a year younger than I am. So, we definitely come from the same place in terms of being in that weird in-betweener, zenial generation, whatever you want to call it. Technically millennial, but like right on the cusp. So, yeah, the fact that there's, you know, the posters, you know, 9/11, Never Forget, and all that being very, very fresh at the time that this movie takes place, but also not feeling the need to be overtly a period piece, I suppose. I mean, not to make you feel old, but I mean, we're talking, you know, 15 years ago, right? We're talking a decade and a half. So it's certainly a period setting, but just little things, you know, like the discussions about Dave Matthews Band, for example. And I love that song, that Crash song, keeps coming up because I absolutely hate that song. And I hated it when I was in high school. And I love the fact that, like, the sort of, like, your opinions about the song or what it would mean to a girl, you know, to girls we went to high school with is so just specific to the time period. And the fact that they, you know, it comes up not once but twice and it's actually sort of a plot point is, I thought, was adorable. You're exactly right. Like, I think it's a film, obviously, about a 17-year-old girl, but as far as films about 17-year-old girls go, this is certainly one that was presupposed to be effective for us.
No, and, you know, it's very funny throughout. Saoirse Ronan is, you know,
delightful. Yeah.
Yeah, she is fantastic, as always. She plays American very well. And, you know, Greta Gerwig makes all sort of the right choices. She avoids, you know, high school tropes and cliches, pretty consistently and intelligently throughout the film. Mm-hmm. You never feel like it's something generic. It feels very
specific,
real and specific because of that. And, you know, things that would have been maybe anticlimactic are, you know, actually nice sort of learning moments. And it just goes to show that you can, you know, it's very real to high school. Things you build up in your mind as sort of seminal turn out to be duds. And then you sort of learn lessons on the way that you weren't expecting to. We can have some minor quibbles, I think, with maybe the pacing of the final third of the film, maybe final half of the movie. But all in all, probably top five movies of the year for me right now, at least.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's really fun to see everybody rallying around it so much and to see it be so sort of universally beloved. I think that that's important for a film like this to be embraced that way, because just I think the subject matter would make it feel to someone who hasn't seen it yet, and maybe I was even sort of guilty of this, as being maybe a little like lighter or thinner or less important as a potential Oscar contender. So thank goodness it's pretty much universally beloved and you know, infallible and wonderful, because that is going to make it hopefully an Oscar contender, and it'd be exciting to see Greta Gerwig get in there as a, you know, hyphenate nominee.
Yeah.
And the Saoirse Ronan thing, she's so wonderful, and obviously she's been cultivating this since she was very, very young. But going into it, I was like, oh, one of my favorite things Saoirse Ronan has going for her is that amazing accent, and she's not going to get to talk with her, you know, Irish brogue this time around. But she acquits herself so well, and she does nail this accent, and she nails Gerwig's, you know, because she's obviously, you know, it's autobiographical, so she's playing. I mean, that must be an incredible amount of pressure on an actress to be like, you know, not just the person who wrote this, but the person who's directing this as well, standing right over there at the monitor. This is, you know, I'm playing her. Like, how difficult must that be to, you know, embody that? A character that could be somewhat interminable if played by a lesser actress.
For sure.
Instead, is just a beautiful thing. And again, it, you know, it really crosses the gender boundaries, you know, like just because it's about a 17-year-old girl, I still identify with so many aspects of this, you know, journey, if you will. And the fact that it's set over the course of one school year, you know, just really helps with the trajectory of it all.
We had a good shout out to the ensemble here, Laurie Metcalf, pulled from, so I mean, I don't even know what Laurie Metcalf's been doing since Roseanne. I guess she must have been on some TV shows, right? Has she been in anything of note that I'm not remembering?
I mean, I know she does a lot of stage work. But yeah, I haven't followed her career very closely. I mean, obviously, it's to my detriment. I mean, she's obviously kind of a standout here, right?
Mm-hmm.
In a film that has such an incredible ensemble, Laurie Metcalf really does, like, I don't know, stand out from the pack, and will certainly be a you know, supporting actress contender.
She'll be nominated, I think, for sure.
Yeah.
And then we got, you know, Lucas Hedges coming off last year. I mean, he's really good in this movie. You never knew if he was going to be sort of a one-hit wonder kind of guy. And Timothy Calumet, also sort of an up-and-comer, and he was really good in his pretentious high schooler role.
Yeah, let's talk about the two of them for a second, because they're both having really big years. Lucas Hedges is also in Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some point. And Timothy, I think Chalamet is how he pronounces
Chalamet?
It. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds more French than mine.
Until this year, you know, probably most known for Interstellar, mm-hmm. One of your favorites. And Laurie Metcalf is she's Andy's mom in all the Toy Story movies.
Oh, right? Yeah.
So well, she got that going for her.
Should have known.
And she's on The Big Bang Theory, it looks like, as well. Anyway, Timothée Chalamet, who of course has Call Me by Your Name coming up here in a couple weeks, mm-hmm. and is going to be a household name here pretty soon. God damn, is he funny in this movie? He, like, again, I just, in terms of the specificity thing, I knew this guy, you know, implicitly. Like, I can't point to, I won't, you know, call out specific names here on this podcast, but I absolutely knew this guy and, like, you know, had crushes on girls who were spending all their time with this fucking guy, right? And when he's sitting on the hood of the car and they go, first of all, just like the fact that they go out to a parking lot. And she's so sort of like underwhelmed with the fact that the hangout spot is a parking lot. Very relatable in high school to me. And mm-hmm. then they're talking about doing something to, they vandalize Lois Smith's car or something, right?
Yeah.
And Timothée Chalamet is just like, it's hella tight. tele-anarchist, and that's it's not just such a specific like West Coast thing to use that word, but just smoking cigarettes and, you know, reading poetry and, you know, saying things are anarchist, or like not wanting to use a cell phone, like that this fucking guy is so I just related
being
to
in
some,
a shitty band.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's just he's such a real person, and Chalamet does so much with that, you know, with very little screen time. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I just found him to be very authentic and you know, interminable and frustrating and hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many moments in the movie where it's just direct flashbacks to people and events in high school, which was exciting and kind of sad, but it felt good. All right, I guess, you know, that about sums it up. It's just a really good fucking movie. Everyone should go see it if they haven't already.
Yeah, and honestly, like, my parents coming into town this weekend for Thanksgiving, I was even thinking of taking them to go see it because, you know, like you said, pretty darn universal and relatable, but also nothing too salacious going on. High school sexual encounters or whatever, and there's some profanity and stuff. But ultimately, I think it is actually kind of a movie for the whole family in a lot of ways.
Yeah, for sure.
And the main unit, Saoirse Ronan, Laurie Metcalf, and then her father, played by the great Tracy Letts, all have very just unique dynamics that work really, really well. You know, like, A, they're just all, you know, wonderful performers, but everything feels very fleshed out in a movie that still feels, you know, pretty much, you know, pretty tight and pretty contained. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just really can't say enough good things about this movie, and it seems like everybody else pretty much feels the same way.
Yeah, it will go down in the pantheon of great high school films, which some needs some new life injected into it every now and then, which is nice.
And debut features as well, right? I mean, she comes from a unique place in that, you know, she was so pivotal in the
Mumblecore universe.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, obviously she cut her teeth there and working with Noah Baumbach so much over the last decade or so. I always bristle a little bit at bringing up his name when talking about this movie because I do think she needs to be given credit for being, you know, her own person, her own filmmaker, her own writer. I mean, I'm sure she was probably showing him cuts and getting notes or whatever, but this really is her film, and I think comedically, kind of stylistically, it may owe some things to, you know, some of the collaborations they had, and I do think the cinematographer, whose name escapes me right now, had shot some of Baumbach stuff. But it's so interesting that the two of them basically had quote-unquote competing movies in the festival circuit this fall.
Yeah.
And hers, I don't know, did you see the Maya Erwitz stories?
I haven't watched it yet. I mean, it's on Netflix, so taking my time. Did you watch it?
I did watch it, and I'm embarrassed to say I watched it on Netflix. And we, you know, we talk too much about Netflix on this podcast, so we can probably get into this at a later time. But just the fact that the way that you said that and the inflection of your voice, and you're just like, oh, it's on Netflix. Like, in other words, I'll get around to it eventually, right?
Yeah.
I think says so much about sort of the danger of this Netflix paradigm. But anyway, it's good. I enjoyed it. I wouldn't call it one of his best, and Lady Bird is 10 times the movie that it is, but I think it's just so interesting to see her kind of like eclipse him a little bit this year. And I'm sure he's, you know, very excited for her and very supportive of that. Ultimately, you put the two films up next to each other, and the Maya Erwitz stories kind of looks like a little bit of a bloated rehash of places he's been before in his career and subject matter he's dealt with, where Lady Bird feels so vital and fresh and new and exciting and so much funnier. So.
Well, it's her, you know, it's her squid and the whale, right? You know, it's,
yeah.
So I think it's probably a little easier to make your first feature if it's your, you know, thesis statement, basically. So,
well, it's her kicking and screaming. Let's be fair. Like, she'll probably get around to you know, a masterpiece like Squid and the Whale at some point, but she certainly is off to a great start.
All right. Well, let's move on to our second film, where there's honestly not too much to talk about. I'm sorry. Spoiler.
Yeah,
Murder on the Orient Express.
Yeah, you told me the other day, you texted me and said, you know, what are we going to talk about, or what do I need to see? And I said, well, we can talk about this, or this, but don't bother with Murder on the Orient Express. And I could feel sort of your disappointment through the text, and you were just like, oh, yeah, I'm going to see it tonight, actually.
Yeah, like, we bought tickets.
It wasn't a question about whether you were going to see it. I wish I hadn't said anything, because then I just straight up poisoned you to the experience, I'm sure.
No, you don't have that much of a pull on me, Matt. Like, there's a remake of a very famous movie, very famous story. Probably didn't need to be done. I was hoping, given sort of when they release the poster, the art, the cast, maybe even the first trailer. I was thinking this might be more of a sort of award season type movie than a glossy studio film that's, you know, put together to try and have big box office, right?
Yeah, I had high hopes. I even kind of invested in it a little bit for our fantasy film league, thinking that this was going to be sort of a prestige-y thing that might have legs because it had so much star power in it, right?
Yeah.
And the original was, the Sidney Lumet Murder on the Orient Express was nominated for Best Picture. Mm-hmm. So I guess I was kind of going on that assumption as well. But it doesn't seem like it's making much of an impact with people, critically or commercially.
It's done pretty well. It's made $100 million in the rest of the world compared to $51 million here in the United States. So it's a financial success, more or less, which is what they clearly, blatantly wanted to do. Or I think they want to start a franchise, right? I mean, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, at the end he does mention, he makes an allusion to Death on the Nile, right? That would be the next adaptation that was planned.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's just a throwaway thing. We're reading too much into it. I don't know.
Yeah, so Kenneth Branagh was hired to make this movie. And it's a fairly handsomely shot film, right? It's professionally done. It's fine.
Shot on 70mm, too. Branagh was inspired by working with his buddy Nolan on Dunkirk. Mm-hmm. And then made the decision to actually shoot this on 70mm film. And that was another reason that I was sort of excited to get to it in the theater. And I actually did get to see it projected on film. And it looks great, but just somehow almost seems like it doesn't even quite take proper advantage of the format. I mean, Branagh's done this, you know, he shot Hamlet. He shot his Hamlet on 70mm as well, so it's not like he's new to the format. It just seemed like the movie couldn't break free from the confines of the train, visually speaking. And as a result, that's just one of the many aspects of the movie that feels a little bit kind of neutered.
So. Yeah, the whole thing is kind of just boring and blasé and vanilla and any other word that means the same thing. You know, I knew the mystery. I knew it was going to happen. So maybe people who this was new for, it would have been a difference, but this is one of the more generic movies I feel like I've seen in a long time. Sort of it feels like almost like a 90s studio picture, in that it's just clearly, you know, it's competently done, but made to make money and to not piss anybody off. Right?
Yeah, that's true. It's true. There's nothing remotely controversial about it. And I guess it's not an unpleasant experience. I need to correct myself, actually. The Sidney Lumet version was not nominated for Best Picture, but Ingrid Bergman won Supporting Actress. Albert Finney was nominated for Best Actor in the Hercule Poirot role. And then screenplay, cinematography, costume design, music, yada, yada. Yeah, I was really, really excited up until about a week before it came out. And I guess it does speak a little bit to my reliance on Rotten Tomatoes and perhaps putting too much stock in Rotten Tomatoes and perhaps spending too much time on Rotten Tomatoes, in that my, you know, level of excitement fell precipitously as I started to see this, you know, drop through the 70s into the high 60s. And because unfortunately, I think that's just about right. You know, like, it's certainly not a disaster, and it's not, like I said, it's not unpleasant, but it also feels like a bit of a missed opportunity given the material and the incredible cast. I'm actually kind of surprised that they released this movie as early as they did, because this does seem like it would be interesting counter-programming, you know, once we get into Star Wars territory here in a couple weeks. This seems more like a December film, right?
Yeah.
More like, I'm home for Christmas with my parents. We need something to get to. We've seen Star Wars twice already.
No, this is a great mom movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, no offense to moms out
sorry,
there.
Mom.
I'm sure that there's a lot of great moms that know films, or a good dad movie or good uncle movie. But yeah, it's a movie that you can take the whole family to, that no one's going to be too upset with.
Uh-huh.
And everyone can have sort of a general good time, and there'll be no anger or animosity towards the movie chooser after the film's over.
Yeah.
But that is not high praise.
No.
At all. Yeah, I mean, the cast is good. People are having a pretty good time. Kenneth Branagh's Poirot is fine. I enjoy Kenneth Branagh's work.
I will say that I think Branagh's performance here is actually much more impressive than his sort of directorial approach. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I was... again, we were both thinking this would be a little more prestige-y, like yeah. you said. I was hoping for something a little moodier, mm-hmm. maybe something a little quieter, mm-hmm. right? Maybe something a little more suspenseful. But this is a little more brash and bright
yeah.
Than what I was expecting. And yeah, I agree with you. I wasn't thrilled with his approach.
It sounds a little weird to say it. I sort of expected something a little longer, too, to be honest. Not yeah. that length automatically equals quality or prestige, necessarily, but ultimately I was like, oh, that's it. I mean, I was familiar. I mean, I'd read the book many, many years ago. I knew where it was going. I just felt that they didn't properly dig in as much as I'd hoped they would. And honestly, I listened to the audio, the Audible version of the book, in the weeks leading up to the film coming out. And it's good. I highly recommend it, actually. It's narrated by Dan Stevens, you know, who played the Beast earlier this year in Beauty and the
yes.
Beast. He does the thing where he actually will, you know, put on the affect when he's performing one of the female roles. So he's going big, and it's, you know, a lot more enjoyable than the film was, unfortunately. But also just very, very CG heavy, you know, like... Yeah. Leaned really heavily on that stuff, especially in some of the earlier, like, Istanbul scenes. For all I know, they may have actually shot some stuff in Istanbul. That's a big, you know, location, you know, filming location these days. But I don't know, the movie felt very much, you know, kind of shot on a green screen. To its detriment, I feel. There was something, and I think this kind of speaks a little bit to that controversial trailer that came out over the summer with the Imagine Dragons song, right? Where there was, like, which you defended a little bit, which I appreciate. But there just seemed to be tonally... kind of a disconnect about, like, what kind of movie are we actually, like, this is the director of Thor, but it's also the director of Hamlet, right? So
yeah.
what exactly are we going for here? Are we really going to go for sort of an old school chamber drama, you know, shot on film and, you know, featuring a cast that, with the exception of Daisy Ridley, is, you know, mostly people in their 40s or 50s? Or are we really going to try and aim for something that's more modern, more mainstream, you know, more interested in sort of compelling teens and 20-somethings to come out to the movie theater? I found myself watching, thinking to myself, who is this movie for?
Yeah.
I suppose, which is never a good thing.
They wanted to cast as wide a net as possible, and maybe that was the right financial decision, you know? If they sliced the budget in half and let Kenneth Branagh make a prestige movie, maybe they make no money, and if, you know, they'd gone the full of the way and turned this into an action movie, maybe everyone would have stayed home. So who knows? I don't know. I mean, would you be interested in seeing Death on the Nile from this same crew?
Yeah, technically I would, I suppose. I'm still in for this Branagh portrayal of Poirot. I guess I wanted as much of a Branagh fingerprint on the direction of the film as he was putting on the performance. Because mm-hmm. I really did. I mean, you know, you see the trailer and you hear the accent and you see the crazy mustache and, you know, people kind of giggle a little bit. But then you actually see it in context and it's clear, like, oh, yeah, that's right. Kenneth Branagh is one of the fucking greatest actors of his generation. So, you mm-hmm. know, he can do everything. So, of course, he could nail this too. But I also know he's a phenomenal director who has the ability to kind of play in both sandboxes, if you will. You know, yes. The Shakespearean sandbox and the Marvel sandbox, if he wants to. So he had a foot in both of them here, and I really wanted him to commit a little bit more. Like, if you are just going to make this big populist remake, adaptation, updating, whatever you want to call it, with, you know, one of the stars of the new Star Wars franchise, and put Imagine Dragon songs on the soundtrack, okay, we can have a conversation about what that movie looks like. But I just feel like there wasn't really a commitment to that kind of thing as much as there probably should have been. But you're right, like, it's probably going to end up, you know, turning a profit, which is cool. I just would be surprised if there was a lot of clamoring for death on the Nile within the next 5 years. So who of the incredible ensemble, who did you feel rose to the top? Who was your, besides Branagh, of course, who were you impressed by, or who do you think really made the most impression?
Oh man! I mean, I like the women in the cast. Mm-hmm. You know, I've never been a huge Josh Gad fan, so he was whatever. And Johnny Depp was whatever. And it's always great to see Michelle Pfeiffer on screen. I like her a lot, and yeah. I like Penelope a lot, of course. And Daisy Ridley, I thought, was pretty good. But I'll go with Pfeiffer and Penelope.
Again, kind of hoping that Michelle Pfeiffer was going to have a big year between this and Mother, and I think she's very good in both, actually. Mm-hmm. I just wish the films around her were a little bit better.
Yeah.
And,
all right.
Yeah. And just the Johnny Depp. I'm starting to feel a little bad for the guy. And honestly, like, I know that he's not somebody who needs our pity, and he certainly may or may not be guilty of a lot of things he's been accused of late. And I don't know. I don't know if he's a good guy. I don't know if he's a scumbag. I don't know if he's if this is the actor he always really sort of wanted to be. You know, like if he was working his way through all the Tim Burton stuff and all like the more impressive stuff of the 90s on his way to becoming, you know, Jack Sparrow and Tonto and whatever he's doing here, maybe this is who he wants to be. Maybe this is what he wants to do. But yeah. I am finding myself starting. I mean, he's become almost a little bit of a punchline, right? Just his role in this film, his approach to this character, and the fact that these are the kinds of roles he's playing now almost makes me feel a little bad for how things have changed for him, considering the fact that as recently as 10 years ago, he was being hailed as, you know, kind of like the greatest actor of his generation or whatever.
Yeah, I don't feel bad for him, that guy.
He owns islands and stuff. You don't need to feel bad for him, I
guess.
Yeah,
I don't feel bad for him at all. He seems to have gotten into this group. Like, he only does these huge budget movies, and I guess that's fine. I mean, he's almost too big to do anything else, right? Like, he's become sort of a monster on screen, right? Like, this is what the smallest role he's played in a long time.
I mean, it's just it almost seems like he's getting into Nicolas Cage territory, right? Where he's not only become kind of a joke, but like he obviously has a lot of legal troubles at the moment. So I feel like he just has to say yes to these kinds of things because he really needs the money at this point, because he's got a lot of lawyers to pay and he's got a big alimony and stuff. And he's sort of become almost a caricature of himself at this point, like Nicolas Cage has as well. So I hope he turns it around at some point, but he certainly seems to be heading in the wrong direction at the moment.
All right, well, Matt, we need to stop delaying. We have to talk about.
You can hear me shuffle. You can hear me dragging.
We're trying not to get there, but we have to do it.
Okay.
All right, let's talk about Justice League. Mm-hmm. Justice League, which failed to crack $100 million domestically this weekend, it looks like. Mm-hmm. It's a movie that's going to be outgrossed by the third installment of the Thor franchise. This is a movie that had trouble production. Zack Snyder, the director, had to leave halfway through. They brought in Joss Whedon to try and salvage a lot of what had been filmed and what needed to be filmed. This is a movie that is sort of shouldn't exist yet, right? I mean, they really did not take the learnings of the Marvel franchise to heart, and they decided to cram three origin stories into a get the band together montage at the beginning of this film. I don't know, Matt. Like, the idea for this movie is bad. The execution is not great. And here we are.
It's almost like, as much as 5 years ago, you and I were talking about this kind of thing, and it was almost like we could see the car accident happening in the future. Not to give us too much credit or say that, you know, these aren't necessarily like our opinions specifically. We're not the only ones who thought that this was a bad idea from the beginning and that this is where we were heading. But but we did presume that when this finally did come together as a Justice League movie, it would look something like this. And that is not satisfying. Like, I'm not happy to say that, like, this is where I expected this to go. I was doing some reading this morning, a little research beforehand, and reading about the George Miller Justice League film that was supposed to that was supposed to happen, and honestly, I didn't know that it was that they were talking about it as early as they were. Like, according to this article, the George Miller Justice League film, which was supposed to be the beginning of a Justice League franchise, as opposed to, what are we now, the fifth film in this DCEU or whatever. Mm-hmm. It actually was being discussed and was very close to going into production before Iron Man, actually. So we're talking 2007, 2008-ish. We were supposed to have this George Miller film. Let's see if I can give you, like I said, George Miller, obviously director of Mad Max.
Happy Feet.
Happy Feet, of course, yes, lest we forget. And it was supposed to take place, or it was supposed to be shot for the most part in and around Sydney, Australia, of course. And you have like Shannon Sossaman as Wonder Woman. You have you have Adam Brody as the Flash.
I knew that. Yeah.
You have Jay Baruchel as lead villain Maxwell Lord. You have Teresa Palmer playing Talia al Ghul. You have Armie Hammer as Batman. You have DJ Catrona as Superman. I have no idea who that is. Sorry, DJ. You have Common as Black Green Lantern.
Oh, cool.
I don't think that's technically how they refer to him. I think they just call him Green Lantern. But anyway, long story short, this ended up not happening. But it would have been interesting to have seen them start a franchise actually with the Justice League. And in a lot of ways, I almost feel like that's probably what they should have done, all things considered, right? As opposed to try to be poor man's Marvel in the way that they've set this up over the course of Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, Wonder Woman, Suicide Squad. That's it, right? Just those four movies and then Justice League.
Yeah. You have a number of options, right? I guess you could have started as Justice League and everyone is where they are, and then you have a bunch of flashbacks or whatever. But like the reason the Marvel movies are good, and this is just a conversation we've had over and over again, is they introduced everyone.
Yeah, they had patience.
They had patience. There's a backstory for all these people. And it is laughable in this Justice League movie how early in the film, we get like two sentences of expository dialogue to explain the entire backstory. Like, those two sentences would have been an entire movie in the Marvel universe, right? and in a movie like this, you're just tossing them together within the first hour, and we're supposed to sort of believe in their chemistry or whatnot. And I understand the idea is to start that they're booting up this Justice League idea, and that's like the last scene in this movie. Hopefully they want a franchise, but like, I doubt Ben Affleck's coming back at this point, right? Who knows if they're going to actually make these individual like Cyborg and Flash movies now. I think the Flash is going forward, but I don't know, man. Like, it's the biggest bummer about this movie is that it was not nearly as terrible as I thought it was going to be. It was still bad. I mean, my expectations were almost impossibly low.
Mm-hmm.
But you can like, oh, you can see the potential, right? Like, they cast this movie pretty darn well. You can be like, this movie maybe could have been good if these characters were serviced properly. You know, it wasn't like Suicide Squad where everything was just awful. The whole thing was just embarrassing. This movie, I think if I was like a 12-year-old boy, I probably would have liked, right?
Yeah, I hear that my 11-year-old nephews absolutely loved it, according to my dad, who absolutely hated it when he took them to it over the weekend. And honestly, I mean, I saw it in a sold-out IMAX screening on Friday afternoon. People seemed really into it, you know? Like, I mean, these are the DC fans. They would be the ones who'd be showing up to pay $23 on a Friday afternoon, right? Mm-hmm. So I was sitting there like a big old grump with a dark storm cloud over my head with my arms folded, not smiling once. And I was surrounded by people who seemed like they were pretty into it and pretty excited and laughing a lot and, you know, yelling out, you know, like, oh my God, there's the Green Lantern Corps, or, you know, there's Deathstroke, you know, like all these characters or references that I'm not getting, which is neither here nor there. But they seemed like they were on board for sure. And I also think that the DC contingent has been undermined and mistreated throughout this whole thing. But as a result, that's kind of like, it's almost weaponized them, right? Like, it's almost...
They need this.
Yeah, they do, because like they almost, it's kind of like a, I think I've made this metaphor in the past, and I apologize if it seems borderline inappropriate, but it almost seems like a political thing where just like your candidate is not necessarily somebody who you agree with ideologically, but they're your candidate by nature of the fact that they're in your party. So you have to support them because you have to support your party. So it's like these poor DC fans have to rally around these things, even if the product is bad.
Yeah.
Right? And they seem like they needed to will. It's almost like they want to will this into quality. You know, like the more that they overcompensate, the better the movies will get. That's just not how it works, unfortunately.
Yeah, and Zack Snyder, you know, I'm sorry, he's gone through some personal, things with his family recently, but he needs to just be locked away, right? Like, he needs to not direct any of these big-budget movies anymore, and I'm a Watchmen apologist.
Isn't it interesting, like, just talk about hindsight being 2020, looking back at Watchmen, and considering the fact that is, if not his best film, certainly his best superhero film, right?
Oh, for sure.
Considering how much shit that movie took. Mm-hmm. I think we were, honestly, like, not to get nostalgic, I think our Watchmen review may have been our very first podcast.
Yeah, so it wasn't even for this podcast. It was for BuddyTV.com.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think we went on like nearly 2 hours on that podcast. That
was, God, what I wouldn't give to find an MP3 of that hidden on a hard drive somewhere. Buddy TV is defunct, right? They don't have archive somewhere. Do by any chance? Do they?
I think they might. It might be hard to find, but maybe we'll do a Google search here.
Oof, that'll be a fun bonus episode. anyway, yeah, we defended it at the time, and honestly, I've been defending Sucker Punch for the last 10 years as well, which is actually harder defending.
Well, if you look at Zack Snyder's last 5 films, right? I think each one has progressively gotten worse. Right.
Well,
you go from Watchmen to Sucker Punch to Man of Steel to Batman vs Superman to Justice League.
Okay. Well, you mentioned that this wasn't as bad as you expected it to be. You think that this is a worse film than Batman v Superman?
I think it is.
It's apples to apples, but I think they're, it probably
pretty
is
similar.
As well. I think here's the litmus test: is given the choice, despite the fact that this one is significantly shorter, which is one of the best things that has going for it. I just think if you just sat me down and just like put a gun to my head and said you had to rewatch one of them right now, despite the fact that I've only seen Justice League once now and it's relatively fresh and it's relatively short, I think I probably would go with Batman v Superman. So that's probably all you need to know about it. And it, like you said, maybe it's not the train wreck we had expected given the direction they're going, but it's completely consistent with all of the mistakes that they've been making. Like, this is not a course correction the way that some people, I think, would point to Wonder Woman as being, for example. And you said that you think that it's not as bad as Suicide Squad, which means that you think that that's the worst film in this DCEU then, right?
Suicide Squad? Oh, 100%.
Okay.
It's one of the worst films I've ever seen. It's one of my least favorite movies I've ever watched.
Okay.
Easily. I fucking hate that movie so bad. Okay.
Yeah, fair enough. I'll have to go back and listen to our episode. I don't remember you being quite so passionate about it. But that's a bad movie.
This movie did not anger me walking out of the theater. I was like, okay, like that's, yeah, I get it. Like, that movie will be okay for like for kids, but holy shit, what a wasted opportunity for all these actors. I think all these actors are good in their roles. And they're just not given much to work with here. Like, the plot doesn't make a whole lot of sense. This is a lot my brother gave me, but like, the bad guy is an Xbox bad guy, right? It's a video game bad guy, and that's how it looks, and that's how it feels, and it's just so generic and CGI heavy. You don't really care that much. And it's just like, oh, he's a big strong dude. Okay, great.
Yeah, played by the great Irish actor Ciarán Hinds in a weird mocap role, and the CG is awful. It's really, really bad. It's distractingly bad. It has been pretty much throughout the whole series thus far. And speaking of Xboxes, not only is he a video game villain, but the MacGuffin is actually a box, right? Or 3 boxes, I suppose, which harkens back oddly to the whole Tesseract situation on the Marvel side, right?
Yes.
I mean, I'm sure this is canon. I'm sure this goes back to the comics or whatever, but they're literally trying to search out these 3 quote-unquote mother boxes, the most clunkily named MacGuffin ever. Mm-hmm. And really, the entire plot just revolves around who's going to get to the mother boxes first, and then what happens when a villain gets the mother box, and what would happen if we were to put Superman's dead body in a pond with a mother box. Mm-hmm. And just everything stems from there, and it's all bad. It's all predictable. It's all muddy, and it's filled with a bunch of sort of shoehorned attempts at levity, most of which I presume were probably attributed to Joss Whedon, but none of them really landed for me at all. Again, I felt like a total stick in the mud. This is really like the first film, even more so than something like Suicide Squad or Batman v Superman, where I literally sat there thinking to myself, I don't think this is for me anymore. Like, I don't think...
it's not.
Again, I don't want to date myself, but I was just like, oh yeah, maybe I'm aging out of this. Like, I really don't think that I'm the audience for this anymore, because all these people seem to be having a really good time and I'm kind of hating this entire experience. But then again, no, I don't think I shouldn't be allowed to enjoy this kind of thing. I just think that this is a really bad example of it. Although, that being said, I also saw Thor earlier this month as well, and I didn't laugh in that as much as I expected to. I didn't enjoy that nearly as much as everybody else seemed to be enjoying it. So maybe I am aging out of this. I don't know. Maybe there's some soul searching I need to do after this podcast with a glass of herbal tea or something.
Yeah, we're both coming to grips with our curmudgeonliness during the Thor podcast, right? Because we didn't like it as much as sort of the audience. But again, I mean, I repeat from the beginning of this podcast, the third Thor movie is going to make more money at the box office, both domestically and internationally, than Justice League, which is DC's Avengers, which should be their biggest fucking movie, right?
Yeah.
And I think that just goes to show you that, no, I mean, aging out of it is not the issue here. It's like they're just not making good enough films, right?
Yeah.
And they haven't engendered enough goodwill from their audience. Of course they're going to get the sort of teenagers or, you know, young kids who want to see Batman and Superman. Of course they're going to get the DC fanatics. But what Marvel has done is gone totally mainstream, right? Everyone wants to see their movies because they know what they're going to get. And I think we were lamenting that a little bit last time. They're going to get sort of a good, bright, fun time. But these DC movies are sort of just dark and boring and generic and nonsensical. And the through lines are not very well laid.
Yeah.
And it's just not as nearly as fun an experience as any of the Marvel movies. And, like, and, you know, there were moments where Ezra Miller is kind of adorable, right? But that's as far as it goes. I mean, Joss Whedon, I guess, did his best to film and rewrite some of the just dialogue scenes, but
I think the best thing you could say about the movie, besides saying, hey, at least it's short, is guess complimenting the fact that I didn't feel like I could really see exactly where the reshoots had. Yeah, I didn't see this. I couldn't see the stitches, you know, mm-hmm. the sutures, if you will, between Snyder stuff and Whedon stuff or the reshoot stuff, which I guess is admirable. Because it's also kind of like thrown together anyway, that I guess maybe there's so many other distracting things that, you know, suture marks aren't necessarily a high priority. But I didn't find myself thinking like, oh boy, that's clearly a Snyder thing. Oh, that's clearly a Whedon thing. Like maybe some of the dialogue-y stuff, I suppose. But to me, it felt, I guess, more comprehensible or coherent, I suppose, in terms of like consistency of tone. I don't like the tone, but at least it was consistent, more consistent than I expected it to be.
Yeah, I mean, the movie is pretty straightforward. It's like, get the band together. We have to find the boxes, wake up Superman, and then fight the guy. That's it.
Yeah, it did also retroactively make me angrier at Batman v Superman as well, because they do that really just manipulative thing where they kill off, you know, the most famous comic book character of all time and actually expect you to believe that this may be, you know, somewhat finite. And then in the final moments, like, I think there's a shot of his grave or whatever, and you start to see the... You see the gravel levitate or something like that, and you're just like, fuck you, movie. Like, and they don't even have the balls to leave him dead for, you know, at least one film. They barely leave him dead for half of this movie before they have to resurrect him.
Yeah, I mean, this also goes back to my issues with DC and Superman himself, which I don't think it's a great character, because, like, you have to come up with sort of gimmicky ways to keep him out of the fight because he's just infallible, right?
Kevin Smith said something I thought was, you know, relatively prescient on a recent podcast. He obviously is an authority on this kind of thing. And I think he actually said this before he saw the movie. So he was like, oh, this is going to be great. They're going to get to explore this kind of like dark Superman arc, right? Like, they'll bring him back from the dead, or he'll come back from the dead somehow, but he'll be, like, he'll be Nega Superman, or, you know, like, he'll be the Superman from Superman 3, you know, like, evil Superman. And that'll be exciting, and maybe he'll become a villain, and we'll get to explore that for a couple films. They don't even have the courage to do that, right?
They do it for about 3.5 minutes.
Yeah. and they also throw in this contingency plan if something bad is to happen, and it smacks of the whole Martha situation in the previous film, right?
Mm-hmm.
When they basically use Lois Lane as a way to talk him down off the ledge.
Yeah.
And this is a quote unquote contingency plan. Why was it a contingency plan? Why don't you just have her there with you on the front lines from the beginning? Like, why not have
the plan?
She should have been the first thing he saw, right?
Yes.
That should be the plan, not the contingency plan.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, let's dance through a couple of these things here. I just made some notes. The iPhone video prologue.
It's just like the most faux, right? Profound bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah. It really feels like a shoehorned. Maybe that is an example of like some sort of reshoot thing, or after they saw, you know, Spider-Man Homecoming, they're just like, ooh, we need to figure out a way to shoehorn in some kids shooting some iPhone video. I guess it's also a way to have the first thing you see in a film where Superman's dead be Superman's live face, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. I'll jump around a little bit, but the fact that there's no central creative force in this universe, right? There is no de facto Kevin Feige for the DCEU. That is the central issue at work here, right? Of why these things don't seem to work. Why there is no like kernel of something consistent throughout this. Why it is so rushed. There's nobody steering the ship.
Yeah, there's no plan.
Besides Snyder.
There's no plan.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it.
Yeah, it's like the South Park joke, right? The underwear gnomes. You know, step one, step one, steal underwear. Step three, profit.
I mean, everyone's made fun of Kevin Feige and like Marvel for having this like insanely like thought out plan, and they have movies, you know, slated for like 15 years from now, and they've had this all going on. But it really is the only way to sort of do this thing. Like, you're dealing with such big productions. What DC clearly doesn't have that Marvel did have is both a patience and like faith that they can make a good movie out of a maybe lesser known like product, right? Mm-hmm. They can start with Iron Man, even though Iron Man isn't like a well known superhero yet. They can make a Thor movie. They can make an Ant-Man movie. You know, DC clearly didn't have the faith that they could make a Cyborg movie. And it took them forever to finally make a Wonder Woman movie, right? Hmm. It's the lack of creative force, and I'm guessing the impatience from the studio heads.
Yeah, and just like struggling, you know, like ravenously playing catch up, and then I think learning some of the wrong lessons from Marvel. Like, instead of doing your own thing, blazing your own trail, kind of like trying to be, you know, your own universe, sort of cribbing all the wrong lessons and like course correcting inappropriately. Like, I was thinking watching this how much they're trying to sort of graft a lot of these Marvel personalities onto different members of the Justice League.
Yeah.
Because Batman basically just now is kind of Tony Stark, right? Like, he doesn't really have any powers. He has a lot of money. He has a lot of technology. He's hard drinking.
Mm-hmm.
He's not nearly as charming or as funny as Downey. And, you know, ultimately, I don't know if it's necessarily Affleck's fault. Like, I think we all sort of made fun of the casting at the beginning. Now I'm just starting to kind of feel bad for the guy because he clearly, like, doesn't, you know, I think he realizes that he kind of made a mistake, whether the decision was for the money or whatever, or, you know, he wanted his kids to be able to see him play a superhero. I don't know what it was. But he's so public in the press about how he kind of wants to weasel his way out of this thing now, right? It just comes across as kind of tragic in its own way.
I think he's done. I don't think he's going to make the Batman movie. I don't think he's coming back, yeah.
So they just write him out, or do they just straight up recast and do a Maggie Gyllenhaal thing?
I think they straight up recast it.
Okay, interesting.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they scrapped this whole thing and it just like started over again.
I mean, it's all going to depend on what the next, what this thing does over the next couple weeks. I mean, it's already done about 300 worldwide, 280 something, which is basically what it costs. I mean, that's basically production cost, right?
You think, yeah.
So they're saying it needs to do 650, 700-ish to turn a profit. And that's going to be asking a lot. That's basically where Ragnarok is at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't cost nearly as much as this movie did.
Yeah,
so,
I don't see it doing that. I think it's going to drop precipitously, especially domestically. So
yeah, we'll see. I mean, the train is already moving towards, you know, Patty Jenkins and the next Wonder Woman film, and you know, the Flash movie, the Aquaman movie, I think is done, right? Didn't they finish? I think they're wrapped.
Is that true?
It's coming. I think it's coming next summer. So there is something to be said for the idea that the train has left the station. I mean, yeah, they can recast or restructure, but I don't think they can afford to just completely reconceptualize the thing at this point, right? I mean, we always talked about this, you know, 6 years ago. We're like, what would Marvel do if you know, if Thor turned out to flop? You know, like, can they afford to have one of these movies flop? Are they going to have to completely scrap this thing?
Yeah.
And that never happened. So we never had to see what that would look like. Now we're in a situation where we may actually see that happening. But how does that work exactly when you're too big to fail?
Yeah, December 21st, 2018, Aquaman. directed by James Wan.
Yeah. Okay, so we got a year till that.
Dolph Lundgren and Nicole Kidman are in this movie.
So you're in, is what you're saying.
Yes.
And I think Willem Dafoe is in there as well. I mean, it's, you know, it's an impressive cast. I mean, these movies can afford to have impressive casts. I just wish they did more things with them. So anyway, so yeah, but Batman, I think, is kind of like he's become our sort of de facto Tony Stark. The Flash is obviously very much a reflection of the most recent iteration of Spider-Man, right? He's just he's a fanboy first. He's excited, you know, he's excited to be involved. He's like way too overeager. And I think that Tom Holland is much better at that than Ezra Miller is, because to me, Ezra Miller's he's always going to be that sort of moody emo, we need to talk about Kevin goth kid,
right? Yes. Like,
I mean, he tries here, but I just, to me, it just, it seems so sweaty compared to somebody like Tom Holland, for whom it seems so natural. And then obviously Aquaman is Thor, right? Like, he's a god. He's kind of a pretty boy. He's got the long flowing hair. He's, you know, he's a little bit of a fish out of water. Pardon the expression.
Oh, God.
To me, sorry, that one's right off the cuff. To me, he seems like a sort of reaction to that. Where, you know, where does that go from? Everybody loved Wonder Woman over the summer. Everybody said, oh, here we go. Like, they've turned it around. They figured it out. They cracked the code. We're off to the races now. And I honestly, like, at the time, I didn't want to be too much of a downer, because it was exciting to see, you know, a film like that directed by a woman become this enormous runaway success. And so I was excited for everybody involved, so I kind of kept my mouth shut. But honestly, like, I think that movie's overrated, and I feel like we needed it to be a hit ideologically because of what it represented. But I don't think it's the masterpiece that everybody insisted that it was.
Well, it's not a masterpiece. It's just a good movie. It's light years beyond any of the other DC movies. And it was kind of hilarious to see the difference between, you know, the female-directed Wonder Woman and the Wonder Woman Amazonian scenes in this movie. You know? There's a lot more cleavage, and there's a lot more midriff bearing. And then Amazonians are just straight up, like, massacred in the first... like 20 minutes of this movie, which is kind of annoying. But
yeah, I think this movie ultimately, like, hinders the legacy of that film, right? It really, like, if Wonder Woman was two steps forward, this is three steps back. So I'm going to read you my personal favorite review of this film. Peter Howell from the Toronto Star. The film is marginally better than last year's sour and dispiriting Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice, but that's like saying that dental surgery is preferable to passing a kidney stone.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, my expectations were so abysmally low. Like, could not have been lower. I was expecting one of the worst movies, and it was slightly better than that. It's damning with very, very, very faint praise.
Did you watch? Did you kind of watch the whole Rotten Tomatoes controversy where they held back and they held back and they held back until the last possible minute? And do you have any opinions about that? Is this a phenomenon we're going to be seeing more and more, especially considering that Warner Brothers is like one of the parent companies of Rotten Tomatoes?
I did not know that was an actual thing. So that's confirmed that it was Warner Brothers who made them hold out.
I don't know if any of that's confirmed. I'm sure we'll probably never get to the bottom of that. I just mean there's something like a conspiracy going on here, right? I mean, we have been sort of conditioned to understand that when a studio won't release Rotten Tomatoes scores, that's always a bad sign. These, you know, this is for your Saw 5 or whatever.
Well, yeah, usually they embargo the reviews, but I don't think the reviews were embargoed. It's just that it was that Rotten Tomatoes weren't notching them, right?
Oh, okay. So this is a Rotten Tomatoes decision, not a Warner Brothers decision? Or are we concerned that because there's some sort of vested interest
or something
here?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it didn't... I don't think it dropped until, like, Thursday morning or something. Like, I was literally about to text you when I was looking at my Rotten Tomato, you know, my app, and thinking, this movie literally comes out in, like, 7 hours, and we still have no... Rotten Tomato score, right?
Yeah.
And is this going to be a sign of things to come? Is there going to be more of this, or is this an isolated incident because they knew they had a, you know, sort of a critical turkey on their hands?
Yeah, I'm sure they wanted the main thrust of the word of mouth to be from the DC fans, and then, you know, you always get those, like, reaction articles where they do the screening for all the big comic book nerds or whatever who are obviously gonna like it. much more than the normal critics. I think the studios are just hyper aware of the effects of Rotten Tomatoes now.
Yeah.
And so they're doing everything they can to game the system, because they also know that if they embargo things and things don't come out, that will also be a big news story too, right? So this smacks of them trying to have it both ways.
I don't know. It's just all very messy and backwards, and I'm actually very disappointed to sort of see all of our worst fears about this kind of thing confirmed.
All right. Well, on that very negative note, I think we should wrap it up.
That's all right. Things are going to get better. We're going to get into the Christmas season here, and things are going to get better. And, you know, I guess we have very good things to look forward to with Star Wars, because if they're willing to give Rian Johnson his own trilogy, then that bodes pretty well for his first outing here, right?
The Last Jedi, the longest Star Wars movie ever.
That's interesting. Hours. Yeah, yeah. That did worry me a little bit. I believe in Rian Johnson. I trust Rian Johnson, yeah. So I'm going to revisit Force Awakens here, you know, sometime next week. Maybe I've
been holding
Rogue
off
One.
On that, too. I'm excited. All right, Matt. Until next time, this has been We Like Movies. Say goodbye.
Sayonara. You've got your ball. You've got your chain tied to me tight. Up again. Who's got the claws in you, my friend? Into your heart, heart beat again. Sweet like candy to my soul. Sweet you are, and sweet you roll. Lost for you, I'm so lost for you. Oh, when you come crashed into me, and I come into you, and I come into you, but in a boy. Your lips just so I know, in your eyes love it glows, so I'm barebone and crazy for you. Oh, when you come crash into me, baby, and I come into you.